We're heading into a new presidential era. Is this finally our opportunity to tame the beast of inflation once for all, to finally shrink federal spending, and to stabilize the value of our currency? Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California, and welcome to Independent Conversations. As usual, I am joined by my colleague, Philip Magnus, holder of the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Welcome, Phil.
Happy to be here.
But today we also welcome Independent Institute Senior Fellow Judy Shelton, who can give us some expert insight into economic and monetary policy questions. Dr. Shelton is the author of a new book from the Independent Institute, Good as Gold, How to Unleash the Power of Sound Money. She's the former chairman of the National Endowment for Democracy and former U.S. director of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. She's frequently testified before Congress, and I believe you were nominated by President Trump in his first term to the board of the Federal Reserve Bank. Welcome, Judy.
Thanks, Graham. Great to see you. Hi, Phil.
So, Judy, if I may be so bold as to say, Judy, even though you deserve to be Dr. Shelton, you know, the exit surveys from the recent election showed that 70% of voters said that they experience hardship from inflation and ranked it as the top issue. Excuse me. And, of course, over the Biden years, inflation jumped about 20%, even though it went back down to a lower annual rate lower. What was the role of Biden's monetary mismanagement in feeding that dramatic inflation that so worried the voters?
Well, I think that his would have been a fiscal role. We know that during COVID, we kind of had to deploy the airbags. I mean, the Fed was lender of last resort. It was a panic situation. I think now we're revisiting some of the decisions that were made. But the idea was to shut down the economy. So a lot of things took place. It's just that it turned out to be a very short-lived economic effect. And after you deploy the airbags, at some point you have to get rid of them so you can see through the windshield and get the car back on the road. And that's where I think both the newly elected at that point Biden administration, in cahoots with the Federal Reserve, which was in no hurry to start cutting off all the stimulus and started to even be persuaded to kind of take advantage of the situation, like any organization. You don't want to lose the opportunity to aggrandize your role. And I think they were sort of forced back into the box, but they took too long to quit the monetary stimulus. And so I would say it was a combination of fiscal spending way beyond when it was required. And that was enabled by the Federal Reserve, who was first in line to buy up all of that government debt.
Phil, what do you think?
Well, I remember back to early 2021 when Biden had just taken office. They gave a press conference where they basically announced, we're going to run the economy hot. And what he meant by that is, we're going to spend like drunken sailors. Well, that might even be an insult to drunken sailors. It was a $1.9 trillion additional stimulus package that he added on top of what we already had from the COVID era. And they were basically deluded into a position of thinking that this would not have fiscal and then monetary repercussions. If you remember the talking point that came out at the time, it said that any inflationary effect will be transitory, and it's all just the settling of COVID and supply chain issues, and we'll be back to normal. So we can therefore afford to run the economy hot. So they were predicting that they'd get away with this. It's basically arguing against reality. And unfortunately, I think they came under the spell of some very fringe figures in the economics profession, the modern monetary theory school. This is the notion that you can basically weaponize and monopolize government's printing press as a mechanism to get whatever you want and not have any inflationary repercussions. Well, they were giving this talking point about, it's just transitory. And for months on end, even some of the mainstream figures of the Federal Reserve and our other economics agencies were repeating this transitory talking point. As the evidence was emerging that we were starting to see inflation creep up.
Yeah, so no, Judy... Phil's exactly right. By July of 2021, we were already seeing the impact of creeping inflation, and yet it wasn't until the following March of 2022 that the Fed quit doing purchases of government debt and even hinted that now it might get off from zero interest rates. So they just held on way too long.
What about the comment that Phil made a moment ago, Judy, about fringe theorists, modern monetary theory? I mean, you're a monetary economist and expert. Do you take offense at some members of your profession being called fringe?
Well, I guess it depends. I've been called fringe. I've been told that using the expression sound money is a dog whisper to the fringe right-wing crazies who use that to refer to this idea that you might want money to be dependable as a store of value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what's a shame is that those theories advanced by Stephanie Kelton,
exactly,
in her book on the deficit myth.
The deficit myth?
Yes. Well, her idea is that deficits do not matter. And her idea is if you have inflation, you increase taxes. So that's how you take pressure off prices. But I think too many in Congress have found that's a very convenient theory to justify not worrying about deficit financing. I mean, if you look at our situation today, if you were a true Keynesian, you would say we should be running a budget surplus.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Because the Keynesian idea was that you kind of go countervailing, countercyclical, but now it's always all deficits all the time. 24/7, 365, year after year after year. I can see why that other theory would be rather, seductive to politicians. Deficits don't matter. Great. Now I can just vote for every spending bill that my constituents will reward me for at the ballot box. Such a comfort.
Well, you can do it for a while, right, Phil? You can get away with it, especially if you're the strongest country and you have the deepest capital markets. But one thing I learned early on with a book, I'm almost embarrassed to date myself, but the coming Soviet crash book came out in January of 1989. And even I was surprised when I thought of our nuclear nemesis. You put on your green eye shade and you start looking at their internal monetary and budget condition like an accountant would. And it was pretty clear that country was going bankrupt. So it can happen, and it can happen relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's always the saying that political delusion is quite a drug for some of these people. You know, go back to the Soviet example, even as early as the 1950s and 60s, we started seeing signs that they were fabricating statistics for external consumption. You remember the notorious example was Paul Samuelson's economics textbook, and he showed year after year this chart of the Soviet economy overtaking the United States.
That's right. No, they were very good.
Every single time they'd update it, and it jumped forward like 5 or 10 years at the point that they were supposed to overtake. But what was really going on is that they had very wishful statistics about the Soviet Union, and it was really covering an economy that was rusting on the inside.
That even reminds me of another story just like that, because the Soviets were very good at statistical deceit. But the story, and I heard it from a Soviet economist, was about Stalin. And he wanted to know what is the value of a ruble compared to the U.S. dollar. And so he had all of his people in the central planning apparatus do their calculations. And they finally put in front of him a figure. And it was that a ruble was worth a third of a U.S. dollar, 0.3. So he put a zero behind that, rubbed out the period. And he said, no, a ruble is worth much more than a dollar. So they made their economic presentation to the world what they felt was a good reflection on the brilliance of central control of an economy.
Well, that's the extreme case for sure. But I think politicians in general are tempted. They're tempted to sort of spin things in a way that's favorable to them. So, for example, with regard to inflation, which is where we started a moment ago, obviously both President Biden and candidate Kamala Harris argued that the underlying driver of inflation was greed. What do you say to that, Judy?
What a disgusting comment. I'm sorry, but that is the last refuge of a scoundrel. That is, to me, if you malign the great entrepreneurs and the businesses that are the heroes of our society, a free economy, the ones who take all the risks, the ones who think of their fellow man, you have to. To be a good businessman, you really have to think about your consumer, your clients. You have to care about them. It makes it the most virtuous form of economic organization. Capitalism is a beautiful thing. And this is also something Keynes wrote about in his tract on monetary reform. Keynes had a few things that are worth remembering. He said that when you, through inflation, turn a businessman who was a pillar of the community into a profiteer, you have destroyed his standing and even his self-respect, because he starts to think, well, I have to raise prices, but am I the villain? So it's just an awful way to shift blame. There was a great commercial that President Reagan cut when he was running in 1980. And he said, labor doesn't cause inflation. Business doesn't cause inflation. Government causes inflation.
Yeah, how true that is. Okay, so we're heading into now a new opportunity, a new era of the second Trump administration. What do you recommend that the Trump team do to actually kill the beast of inflation instead of just jawboning, or instead of, you know, talking down businessmen or threatening like candidate
price
Harris
controls,
did, price controls on the nasty supermarkets? And what would be the positive recommendations that you think the Trump team ought to consider to beat inflation on a more permanent basis?
Maybe they could hire brilliant entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, and maybe start slashing government spending. That would be a good start. And I think they're doing exactly that. I love it. With regard to the Federal Reserve, I think this might be an opportunity to look at not only the need for sound finances, but sound money. And I think that led by Senator Mike Lee, who is quite a constitutionalist, this is a good time to reassess what is the appropriate role of our central bank, the Federal Reserve, in a free market economy. I think we might even have to say not only have we seen no accountability for the worst inflation in 40 years. It's one thing to stand there as the chair of the Fed and say price stability is the responsibility of the Federal Reserve. Great. It sounds noble, but nobody got fired for what happened. And it's not that per se. It's that, how do you provide restitution to all of us as citizens who have lost purchasing power as a result of having to use the legal tender of our country, and yet the government doesn't treat it as a moral contract, which I think they should. The Fed, for its own convenience, debases the dollar deliberately 2% a year, and that's lost purchasing power. I consider that expropriation.
Absolutely.
That is your private property that you earned and you're saving. And I do not like the government to manipulate money as just another economic instrument, instead of respecting, as the Constitution suggests, actually as the Constitution decrees,
mandates,
that money be a reliable measure, in the same way that all official weights and measures were given up to Congress to decide what they would be, these unvarying standards, regulating the money was in the very same sentence, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And I'm happy that we're challenging some of the practices of the Fed, which I don't think has enough legislative oversight, merely having the chairman report twice a year to Congress, during which time, I must say, there are just disparate questions put forward concerning vested interests, special projects of individuals. Maybe they're worthy, but there is no sustained line of inquiry to really question the Fed about its practices, the powers it has accumulated, its prominence in financial markets. I think its unequal delivery of financial rewards to some members of our society at the expense of others. If you already own financial assets, I think you're doing quite well. But if you don't, I think you have a strong case to say, I'm a victim of monetary favoritism. And I think that could be a real problem that we need to address. The inequality of wealth has been exacerbated by the Federal Reserve's monetary policy decisions.
I'm fascinated by your observation that even the 2% goal, if it were attained, would itself constitute an ongoing, essentially confiscatory tax, and probably the most regressive of all taxes. So
that's how I see it.
Yeah,
right, Phil.
That's exactly it. I mean, you have a Federal Reserve that pays lip service to price stability. It's exactly as Judy says. I mean, you have the chairman appears before Congress and says, "Yes, we're pursuing our goals." Well, what do we know from the last 4 years? First off, they weren't really pursuing the goal of price stability. They were deluding themselves and presenting to the public this notion that inflation's transitory. And in the meantime, they're meddling in all these other policy areas well outside the mandate of the Federal Reserve. You had the Federal Reserve putting pressure on banks to pay attention to climate policy and ESG and diversity, equity, and inclusion hiring, all these areas of, debate whatever you want about those policies, but they are not the function of the central bank. And really, they're kind of asleep at the wheel for almost 2 years, dabbling in areas well outside the purposes of their original mandate, while the major problem, the one thing they're charged to do, price stability, is just running out of hand.
Yes, and what does stable prices mean? It means they're stable, and they have reinterpreted that to mean stable inflation.
Yeah, continuous
right.
Inflation.
That's what they mean. Mm-hmm. Yeah, an incremental, ever increasing inflation, but at enough of a gradual rate that you don't feel it as much.
Yes, so they're just skimming a little, but it's not to your advantage. And if you had let's say you took your earnings and you put them under your pillow. You're not a sophisticated investor. You don't want to risk anything. So you just keep them under your mattress, we'll say. And in 10 years, now you're ready to use them. 20%
right.
has been taken away.
Right.
That's expropriation.
It really is. This is why, I think the most compelling thing you said in your recently published book with us, which is Good as Gold, How to Unleash the Power of Sound Money. We're very grateful that you published this book with the Independent Institute. And in the book, in the preface, you recount your experience before the Senate Confirmation Committee hearing process, which ultimately was not successful. But then to them, you said what you said to us a moment ago, that that money is a moral contract. And you analogized it just now to stability and, what a pound is and what an inch is and so forth. These very fundamental measures of value in other respects are comparable to what the currency ought to be. So is there a way to help people understand how money is a moral contract between government and the people, and to somehow decouple the value of money from the whims of bureaucrats and politicians? Can money be decoupled from their whims, Judy?
Well, that's what we will try to do. I do offer a specific initiative in the book to begin to do that, but you have to do the groundwork. to prepare a movement, because I think we've all become entirely too accustomed to accepting that the Federal Reserve is sacrosanct. And when they talk about their dual mandate, you know, it comes out of legislation from 1977 and 1978. So there was the Federal Reserve Reform Act, and then you have what we call the Humphrey-Hawkins Act. But that legislation actually called for 0% inflation by 1988. So this was totally an invention by the Federal Reserve. And they decided, you can look at the transcript. It was a very interesting conversation in July 1996. Janet Yellen kind of took the lead. She was a governor of the Board of Governors at the Fed. Alan Greenspan was the chairman. He said, how do we interpret our mandate for price stability? He said, it seems to me it's obviously 0% inflation.
Well, he didn't win that argument, did he?
He did not win that argument. She put forward the very Keynesian grease the wheels approach.
Exactly.
But it's really based on money illusion that since people, she said, psychologically would never want to not get a raise or even have their wages go down slightly in the event of an economic downturn and the company's saying, well, everyone's going to have to take a little less until things get better. She said, people don't take to that. So what you need to do is really camouflage what you're really doing.
In inflation.
Let's say if you had 2% inflation, you could actually give your employees a 1% increase in their nominal wages.
It would still be a decrease.
Yes. But
exactly.
The whole idea was, and they wouldn't notice. They wouldn't notice. When you read that transcript, she talks about a survey that, and her husband, of course, George Akerlof, a very noted economist, I would say leftist in his views,
yeah.
But he's very accomplished. He had done a survey on just this point, which she cited, and showing that people said, well, if I got a raise and it really didn't amount to a raise because of inflation, would I still be happy? And just over half said, yeah. And then she then said, and I think I would too, because if you're a worker, usually they're the last to get compensated for inflation. So at least
exactly.
If I were brought up, maybe I would be happy. So I think they were more sophisticated than she was giving them credit. But then what bothers me, she said, you'll all be happy, meaning you all sitting around the big mahogany table here at the Federal Reserve building, the Eccles building in Washington, D.C., you'll all be happy to know that they gave the same survey to economists, and they said no, they wouldn't be happy. And it shows parenthetically laughter. And I thought, what hubris, because that's suggesting we get it, but these workers don't. And I think we've seen from labor negotiations and people demanding actually very, very elaborate cost of living adjustments because they don't fall for that trick. So if that's the justification for having a nominal inflation rate that obscures the real interest rate and the real inflation rate, I mean, where you have to shift up the real rate, you have to add the inflation to get the rate that the Federal Reserve sets as their target interest rate, I think that people do get it, and that's no longer the appropriate rationale for debasing the currency deliberately 2% annually. And that's assuming they could even hit that target.
Right, which they haven't quite even made yet. Well, that sounds like in some ways conditions are favorable then for building the kind of awareness that you mentioned a moment ago, which would be the necessary precondition for fundamentally resecuring our currency. If people, it seemed like they were inured for some decades to constantly losing ground, like being the sand, walking on the sand on the beach, and the waves are constantly eroding and underneath you, you get used to it. But people are not really inured anymore, but they're kind of figuring it out. Does that lay the groundwork of awareness that could lead to a change in how we secure the value of our money.
Yeah. Well, it's the slow erosion we had for years and years suddenly became a very rapid erosion in 2021 and 2022. And people noticed that. I think one of the other interesting things in the postmortem after the election, you're trying to see some of these figures on the economic left and the far left really explain how they lost the case on inflation. And unfortunately, I think quite a few of them have deluded themselves. In the New York Times, they had a modern monetary theorist. Isabella Weber wrote a big piece the other day announcing, well, you know, we lost the election because of the inflation issue being very salient among voters. But the reason we lost is because we didn't have price controls. We didn't do all these fringe ideas that they had been floating as part of the campaign. So they're taking exactly the wrong message away from the experience that I think most Americans have felt in their pocketbooks over the last several years.
I think Phil is exactly right. But now we've reached a point, and the testimonial is the election results. People have had it. They have had it. And inflation, they felt it at every level, psychologically, in their pocketbooks, and impacting their standard of living. And I think they were tired of being told, no, really, everything's fine. And they said, it's not fine. And that's why I think, yes, now I believe that we have reached consensus on that issue. And that does, I mean, timing is everything. I remember Milton Friedman would say that something is impossible until it becomes inevitable. So that's what I'm hoping to put forward, an initiative described in Good as Gold that is something that we could do. Something we could do that goes to the heart of this. And I actually think it would be good. It would be a way to capture kind of a windfall profit for the federal budget, which is something that would be welcome.
Not bad, yeah.
As we're looking at the deficit, let's try to find ways to generate revenue as well. But the U.S. used to have a dollar convertible into gold. I mean, Phil knows our monetary history so well. But certainly the founders had gold and silver in mind when they said that they were going to set really what the dollar was. I mean, in Thomas Jefferson's notes on the establishment of a money unit, I believe that was 1784, he said, if the dollar is our money unit, then we must say with precision what a dollar is. And that turned out to be 5 grains of gold or 371 grains of silver. And, oh, excuse me, 25. And then we made $5 and $10 eagles. But we put a precise measurement, a precise weight of gold on our currency. And that was a way to fit into an international monetary system.
Yeah,
that is the way the world connected at the time. So you had a level international monetary playing field. And then we went through the Civil War, we went through greenbacks, then we got back onto having a gold-backed currency. By 1880 through about 1913, World War I, the entire world was on the classical international gold standard. It was a very sophisticated approach. It allowed individuals to convert currency into gold. It kept this stable platform so that international trade was carried out on the principles of comparative advantage and Adam Smith doctrine. And so you had a really wonderful, flourishing international trade world happening. Wars tend to kick countries off monetary systems. We tried to get back on in the 20s by the 30s, it had turned into a big mess of beggar thy neighbor, where countries would go on a gold standard, and then they would decide, well, we'll get a trade advantage by devaluing our currency to make our goods cheaper in our export markets. And then some of that even led to World War II. That's a lot of people feel that fueled the social tensions.
Right. It immiserated the Germans and all.
the downward economic spiral as international trade just succumbed to, you would have the devaluation and then the counter tariffs to try a trade war.
It's literally
a trade
war.
Because it was the only way to retaliate against this unfair trade advantage of devaluation, of competitive devaluation, we called it. But it was really just cheating. And it was interesting when the U.S. next initiated a gold-anchored international monetary system
after World War II.
Mm-hmm. After World War II. Well, actually, the war was still raging.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Bretton Woods took place in July of 44, about 3 weeks after D-Day.
Yeah.
And you had representatives from 44 nations, but they had been inspired by this idea put forward by the U.S. that we know if you don't have a vision of a better world, if you think that after the war we're just going back to the 1930s, you're not going to have the will to fight. So we want to assure you now there will be something better. There will be this level international monetary playing field so that we'll have fixed exchange rates. The dollar would be convertible into gold at a fixed rate to anchor it all. But that way, capital will be available to be invested to help you rebuild your economies. You'll be able to export again. And the years under Bretton Woods, about 25, I'd say, you had fantastic economic growth. You had tremendous increase in productivity. You had a narrowing of wealth inequality. You had great worker participation. And then we went off of that. All of this is a long way to get around to saying the gold that the United States still retains from that era amounts to 261 million ounces. And since the end of that era, since the early 1970s, over 50 years ago, we have been carrying that gold at a value of $42.22. There is now a windfall profit. If you mark to market, it's closer to $700 billion. Now, I don't want anyone to say, oh, well, why don't we just sell it? Big mistake. Britain did that under Gordon Brown. I had a taxi driver once tell me in London what a dumb thing our prime minister did. People get that. What I want to do is use that. Let's put it to use. Let's use those holdings as specific collateral for a new Treasury-issued instrument that would be denominated in U.S. dollars and convertible at maturity into gold at the option of the bondholder. So now, after those 53 years, I want to issue, starting on July 4th, 2026, when we celebrate the 250th anniversary of our nation's founding, let's say we're going to be here in 50 years, standing tall. This bond we're issuing today will mature on the 300th, on July 4th, 2076. And let's use this bond as a beachhead, a kind of like a tips bond, in that let's see how people measure a U.S. government obligation that's redeemable in a solid dollar, a dollar that is convertible into gold. So this is a trust but verify thing that gives it an advantage over other Treasury instruments that are redeemable in dollars that may have been grossly diminished through inflation, unless you bought a Treasury inflation protected security. That's what this would function as, this barometer to see if the U.S. can get its fiscal and monetary house in order, back to sound finances, back to sound money, and let it trade in secondary markets so that we're constantly aware of the interest rate on a security you can trust, because you know you will get a pre-specified amount of gold in the future if you don't trust the dollar, and see how that trades against nominal Treasury securities, that is traditional conventional Treasury securities. That, you know, Greenspan came up with this idea in a 1981 Wall Street Journal op-ed. He said, let's issue gold bonds.
Right, right.
And he knows something about monetary policy, and he wanted to do that.
But they didn't.
They did not.
Mm-hmm. But they could, and now we could, potentially.
Reagan wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Reagan said, my first priority as president will be to make the dollar, through some kind of gold backing, the most trusted currency in the world. Now I think we can do that. I think we should do that. That fits in with the idea of maintaining the global reserve currency status of the dollar, but let's make it even better. Let's make the dollar great again, or you might say let's make gold money again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or make money real money again.
I like it.
So these ideas, I want them to be as widely heard as possible. So I'm so glad you're having this conversation with us today. Let's make sure we get this conversation widely heard. And are these details also in your book, or some of them?
Yes, laid out pretty specifically, but I'm open. I think you would need a team. Frankly, we've already, I think, gone through a big hurdle in that I believe we have a president who would be open to hearing mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. The idea of capturing the market gain, potentially the idea mm-hmm. of collateralizing, specifically mm-hmm. protecting our gold holdings, but putting them to use. What are we going to do? Just keep them sitting there doing nothing for another 50 years?
Right.
Why not use them for this purpose, to shine a light on the sincerity of tackling this existential threat of fiscal unsustainability? How often mm-hmm. do we hear that mm-hmm. phrase, especially from our Fed chairman? So let's do something. Let's start to say, how will we keep track of whether we're moving toward that goal? And if we can achieve that goal by slashing expenditures, which I think we're now well on our way to taking a serious swing at that, then can we also restore the monetary integrity of our mm-hmm. currency, and in that sense, make the dollar literally as good as gold.
Mm-hmm. There's a chance at these things being taken seriously now, which is pretty inspiring. I'm kind of stunned.
Right. Well, it's an interesting moment, and notice there's a theme here, moving toward a sound money mechanism or standard. It actually takes the politics out of the Federal Reserve. Uh-huh. It's depoliticizing it. The major problem we've had for the past several decades, and really back into the early 1970s when Nixon finally killed the gold standard, it's turned the keys of the central bank over to political influences. It's allowed Congress to have an outsized presence. It's allowed presidential appointments to have an outsized presence on manipulating the monetary base of the country in a direction that either overheats, runs the economy hot, to paraphrase what Biden said right after he took office. It makes it susceptible to pressures in ways that if you actually chain it to gold, you're removing it from the political oversight that seems to have been a major source of the mischief we've just experienced, and really the mischief that's been ongoing for 50 years.
I like that. And I think it's more organic because you could have bondholders. This could be like a savings bond. People might buy it for their grandchildren. But the point is, you're now sort of putting that interest rate for a dependable dollar in the hands of individuals, closer to what a gold standard did, instead of just mm-hmm. being an instrument of government that the rest of us have to accept. And I think that's very important. And in that sense, you're harnessing the power of the market. Mm-hmm. And I think that also then brings free market economic forces into play, because the Fed doesn't even, it's an anachronism to talk about open market operations,
right,
because they really don't. That's not how they set interest rates. They do it by diktat, through administered rates. The Fed just votes on what they think the rate should be. They don't do what Paul Volcker did and interact with banks to decide what rate they lend to each other. Those were in the days when banks actually were making loans and wanted to be loaned out, and they only kept money at the Fed because they were required to. Now there are no required reserves. Banks are keeping $3.2 trillion sitting at the Fed because they get paid 4.65% on cash doing nothing, that is not providing financial capital to the real economy. The Fed has turned banks into utilities who find it a more profitable business model to just engage with the Fed. I think the reason we see long-term rates going up when is a function, it's a mechanical function of this mechanism that the Fed uses. Because if I'm heading a bank and I see that I can get 4.65%, and this is a government-guaranteed, riskless investment coming out of taxpayer funds, what's the difference? That's in an array of, I could buy 3-month treasury bills, I could buy 5-year, 10-year. So I think when I hear, for instance, at Chair Powell now sort of suggesting we might not lower, we were going to recalibrate, but now post-election, we might not lower. I'm thinking, well, then I'm just going to stay in this government guaranteed investment of just leaving my money at the Fed. And so that reduces the demand for the longer term treasury instruments. And the lower the demand, then the higher the rate. So that's what I see. To me, that explains why we see the longer term rates go up, because there's less demand. And normally the banks are the big buyers. And they're better off. They have their master accounts at the Fed. Just leave it sitting in cash. You're getting a terrific return. It's weird. The Fed actually has three parts to its mandate. It's not just stable prices and maximum employment. It's also, according to that legislation from the 1970s again, they're supposed to guarantee or promote moderate long-term interest rates, which to me suggests you would have a normal yield curve. Lower rates for the shorter term and higher rates if you have your yield to maturity curve. Why don't they take that as seriously as they take the other two parts of the mandate? Because if you had that, you wouldn't allow the Fed to offer higher short-term rates than these longer-term rates. And I think that's distorting the yield curve very much.
One thing I find very encouraging as well as intriguing by your proposal to reintroduce an element of gold connection. I like the idea of that, because it's not the case, as some might accuse you. Some might accuse you of saying, well, we're going to flip the whole thing upside down and make every dollar immediately, instantly convertible into gold. And people say, oh, that's too big a change. We can't manage it. It'd be too difficult for the markets to digest. But that's not what you're proposing.
That's not what I'm proposing. I mean, I'm trying to be realistic. I'm not proposing that. It's a very, very simple mathematics. The Fed has issued Federal Reserve notes. That's paper currency. They have about $2.5 trillion of that outstanding. If you even made just the paper money convertible into gold, you'd wipe out our $700 billion just like that. I mean, it's not only not feasible, 70% of those U.S. dollars in paper circulate outside our country.
Yeah.
And we don't know what they're funding.
Exactly.
But so that's, I would never suggest that.
Right. I know.
What I'm saying is, let's do something we could truly do. I think you could do it either as an initiative of an incoming Treasury Secretary. And I think, as I say, I hear the Trump administration talking about a golden era. I like the sound of that.
Oh, yeah.
But
like golden era.
yes, but you're right. I'm certainly not suggesting, because people don't really know. I don't know, unless you specify, what is meant by a gold standard. Do they think that means that you can turn in your checking accounts to a government branch office that's going to suddenly give you a pile of gold? When the U.S. was on the gold or the bimetallic standard, say in our founding fathers' day, one of the first things Thomas Jefferson said to build, and we did, was a mint. All a mint would do is they didn't hand you gold in exchange for paper. What they said is, you bring in your own gold and silver, and we will verify and stamp it and certify that after melting it down and then re-minting it, this is a U.S. dollar or mm-hmm. this is a U.S. $5 or $10. We will mint your wealth. What the Constitution and especially Article 1, Section 10 expressly forbids is to have government, and in that case, we're talking states, issue bills of credit. What you weren't allowed to do, because they'd learned from the travesty of colonies issuing IOU notes by their governments, and it was just disastrous because they forced people to accept that as money and use it to settle debts. So the one thing you couldn't do was that. But the Congress has farmed out this responsibility to a government agency, and that's exactly what happens now. The government issues IOUs, and then that is monetized, and then you have to use that for transactions. So that's why I think we need to re-examine the role of the Federal Reserve in our free market economy. We should be asking, should there be any limits on the amount of government debt our central bank can purchase? When Poland made the big switch under Leszek Balcerowicz, their finance minister, away from a communist approach, a command economy, to a free market economy, the first legislation they passed was to say the central bank is prohibited from purchasing government debt because it enables this abuse of the money. So I think this is sort of the movement, the way we should go. Should the Fed be allowed to create base money with the stroke of a keyboard?
Yeah.
They just out of thin air.
Right.
Should there be any limits on the amount of interest the Federal Reserve can pay to commercial banks at taxpayer expense to leave money sitting in cash, not doing anything to fund the real economy? And then finally, I think we really do have to look at this issue of, would Congress have approved deliberate debasement of the U.S. money unit? Because after the decision was made at the Federal Reserve for 2%, the next day they met, they said, let's not really vocalize this. Let's not mention this to Congress. McDonough, I think, is the one who said that, because this might, again, look at those transcripts from 96. This might not be in keeping with how Congress would interpret the role of our central bank. And then it became official under Bernanke that they were chasing the 2% target. And I just think we need to review that decision. And I think we should review all the arguments. Does the Fed really need the policy space? That's why the Fed defends it.
Yes,
because,
Sheila.
Oh, they could go down to zero rates, but that's why they want to have a little margin, more policy space. I'm sure they'd rather have it be 4% or 6% to give them policy space. But I don't think that's justification. And going to zero rates has never really solved anything. It's created more problems, more distortion, more malinvestment. And the final reason is the deflation argument. I think that we have overdone that. A certain amount of mild deflation is actually healthy and normal through innovation. Look at what you get now in a cell phone. Think of what you used to pay for a Hewlett-Packard calculator, maybe $1,500 when they first came out. Now you get it free at the grocery store.
Right.
The natural inclination of a generalized price level would be to deflate slightly. Even if the Fed had a 0% target, it would be mildly stimulatory, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
When people talk about deflation as the great bugaboo, like, say, China, what they might be going through, they're talking about consumer demand falling because of much more fundamental problems in the economy,
mm-hmm.
of a government intervention, of things actually failing. And that's what real deflation is. And then the deflation is a symptom of a failing internal economy. And so I don't think we should let this slight concern, we're not going to slip into that unless we're really in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of deflation, or as Jerry Jordan said, I'll just wrap up that final transcript of 96. He was a member of the Federal Open Market Committee then. He said, I think if you give a survey to workers, you should say, would you rather have 2% or 3% inflation, which would mean in 100 years, your dollar would be worth 5 cents or 13 cents. And he said, I think most people answering that would say, why shouldn't it be worth a dollar?
Exactly.
Why not have it be zero, and it's still worth a dollar in 100 years, and then the rest of us don't have to constantly renegotiate a cost of living allowance,
right,
or have to think of our life and plan our life in terms of inflation-adjusted numbers. Why, for the Fed's convenience, should the rest of us pay this price? I think that we should demand sound money.
We're at a moment where these things might become possible. If we could anchor our money in stability, free it from bureaucratic control, and then get a real hold on government spending, we might be able actually to usher in an era of considerable prosperity and even greater income inequality as things normalize and regularize through regular trade and exchange. I'm optimistic after listening to you, in other words, Judy.
The money should work the same for everybody. Right.
Exactly.
Now, the Fed is in a position to skew financial rewards to people who already own financial assets. In the last 4 years, $42 trillion has been created. That's the increase in U.S. household wealth. That's based on Federal Reserve numbers. 62% of that went to the top 10% wealthiest Americans. That, I think, goes against our principles of equal treatment under the law. And I think it's dangerous to have a central bank be in that position. It makes it inherently political.
Right. So a couple of quick questions. We're kind of coming toward the end here, but I'm excited by President-elect Trump's apparent eagerness to cut spending. So, you know, with the help of Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and so forth, Department of Governmental Efficiency.
Right.
It encourages me, but I also wonder if you create yet another federal-level cabinet agency, would the DOGE become yet another, you know, dinosaur in the long run to be captured by some future president who doesn't really want to cut spending? Is that a risky move?
No, they're okay. Not. They're saying that they will disappear.
Okay.
They're not a government agency. So
sunset from the
beginning. Their own obsolescence. That's
yes. And meantime, they're going to. They announced today that at Doge on
Doge.
X, they are going to do a weekly live stream of proposals, the best proposals.
Uh-huh.
That is to get rid of the most outrageous waste of government spending and show their progress and communicate. And I think that level of transparency is brilliant and will be very well received.
That sounds encouraging. I saw a thing in the Wall Street Journal, was it yesterday, where Elon Musk has been advocating that federal contracting be changed. So instead of a cost plus basis, do it on a fixed price basis, fixed price contract bids for companies providing goods or services to the federal government. Could that be a meaningful way of reducing expenditures, do you think?
I'll ask Phil. Sounds good to me.
Potentially so, as long as they can keep it from being politicized.
Yeah,
I think
but
this is the great risk of any spending.
Yeah, appropriations process can be rife with corruption. We've seen enough of that actually in Department of Defense purchases.
Exactly, yeah, notoriously so. Okay, one last issue, and I don't have time to talk about it at length, but is the prospect of new and higher tariffs a threat to this anti-inflationary and prospects that we've been talking about here?
Well, I see tariffs always in the context of retaliation. I'll go back to that 1930s episode. It's no surprise to me, the dollar, strong currency, as much as I'm critical of the dollar losing value domestically, if you look at the currencies of our top five trade partners, of Europe, Canada, Mexico, China, and Japan, I look at it over the last 10 years, and I measure it against this common reserve asset, against gold. Just, I'm not saying how they did relative to the dollar. I'm just saying if you use the common reference point, they have all debased more even than the dollar. So to me, it's if you are going to incur this unfair trade advantage, tariffs have always been used as a way to bring you back up to the same level. You are protecting your own workers, but I think quite legitimately from unfair competition. Mm-hmm. If a country, I don't think you can eliminate, you have unequal human rights standards among our trade partners, particularly in Asia. You have unequal environmental standards.
That's for sure.
But I don't think you can correct for all those things. Labor is going to be cheaper in some countries.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, currency manipulation is a form of unfair trade advantage that you can statistically quantify. And that's where I think if you had our trade partners see what we do in issuing a gold convertible sovereign debt obligation, and you suggests that they should be willing to do the same. Now I think you're beginning to bring market forces into saying who has the more credible promise here not to devalue their currency. You also may have the beginnings of a future fixed exchange rate system.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need is a true international monetary system. What we have is one big fat mess that my friend Jacques de la Rossière calls an anti-system.
So maybe there's a place for tariffs as a short-term leverage or rectifier to get where we really need to go.
As I see it, as a rectifier against unfair trade practices, mm-hmm. I particularly focus and have always thought, back in 2015, when I first heard candidate Donald Trump talk about currency manipulation, I thought, that is a bipartisan issue. I have heard mm-hmm. Democrats in auto manufacturing states argue just as vehemently for some kind of punishment or retaliation, who would say auto workers at that time, even going back decades, said, we can compete against the best producers in the world, but we can't compete against the Central Bank of Japan.
Right, right.
And so I think he brought up a very worthy issue. And so that's where I would look to say tariffs that reflect an acknowledgement of the unfair advantage achieved by countries who let their currencies be devalued against the dollar. We're acknowledging it. And maybe that's the beginning of saying, yes, if we had a level international monetary mm-hmm. playing field, we could eliminate those tariffs.
So not ad hoc, but as part of a comprehensive strategy. You could see a place for such tariffs.
Yes, and it's not just the reciprocity, which has been discussed, and it is leverage in trade agreements, but I also think it would be visionary and to mm-hmm. say we really need to have to legitimize and to have people really accept the benefits of international trade, to save international trade.
Not to kill it.
Not to kill it. It would really be to say it has to be in keeping with the logic and the principles of Adam Smith. Mm-hmm. And in those days, everyone was on the same international monetary system. I think if you can restore that, then you start to see the logic and the rationale once again to achieve those great benefits from having an open global marketplace, but everybody abiding by the same monetary standard.
We're going to draw this to a close in a moment, but Phil, I don't know if Phil Magnus might have a final question or comment before we do so. Phil, anything on your mind you want to ask Judy before we say goodbye?
I will just return to the theme here. I think the notion that we can depoliticize the use of our monetary system, the use of our central bank as a way to both engage in favoritism, as a way to elevate certain presidencies and regimes, the more that we move in that direction, we're actually arriving at a world in which politics are removed from central banking or removed from the monetary basis. And I think this is an interesting point to emphasize because the charge that's always made by those who oppose a gold standard, oppose sound money, is, oh, you're injecting politics back into the Federal Reserve. Really, it's the exact opposite that seems to be playing. We are removing politics that has been inserted over the past half century through intentional actions of monetary manipulation.
With that being said, let me just thank Dr. Judy Shelton very much for joining us at Independent Outlook. You are a senior fellow here at the Independent Institute. We're very proud of you. And let me remind our viewers that we do keep quite an archive of all of Judy Shelton's Wall Street Journal op-eds and other things on our website, independent.org. Visit our website for that kind of information and more. Take a look at this wonderful book, Good as Gold, How to Unleash the Power of Sound Money by Judy Shelton. And thank you so much, Judy Shelton.
I'm very, very grateful to you, Graham, and Phil is my most esteemed colleague. I'm honored that Independent Institute published the book, and I appreciate, and it's my greatest honor to be affiliated as a senior fellow. I'm very proud of it. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. We're delighted, and let's look to the future with some hope based upon what Judy Shelton has told us. Thanks again. We'll see you again next time on Independent Conversations. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.